Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First package on the list today is LensFun. This is an open source database of camera lenses, or rather of the characteristics of camera lenses, of common camera lenses. So here's the Slackware package lists the project website as lensfun.sourceforge.net. You go there, it points you to their new home on GitHub. So that's lensfun.github.io or github.com/lensfun. What is it? Well, it says, the goal of the LensFun library is to provide an open source database of photographic lenses and their characteristics. That's what this is for. It's not just a database of camera lens names, though. What this is it's a database of camera lens characteristics, meaning there's this lens and therefore, the curvature of the image is a certain, you know, it has a certain amount of curvature around the edges, or maybe it has a slight fisheye effect, you know, at the very center, or whatever, you know, like different characteristics of what a photo would look like according to what kind of lens was used to capture that image, because lenses aren't perfect. They have irregularities. They have unique traits that maybe are intentional, maybe not, whatever. This database identifies those. This is kind of an interesting project too, because it started out as an open source database, and then the author of that database, or the maintainer of it or whatever, decided that they wanted to do this commercially instead, and closed, you know, the database became closed its doors, no longer an open source project. Well, it was open source though, so people, some other group, the LensFun group, took the database in its final state, just before going non-open, and continued using it. Used that as the base for this new LensFun database. So that's kind of cool, because it's just one of those times where the open source license has managed to preserve a really cool project that, for whatever reason, decided to discontinue. I think it's really easy as an open source enthusiast to look at that kind of thing and sort of get pretty judgy about it. You know, you think, well, there was this great open source database apparently of these lenses, and then the author decided to not make it open source anymore. And that feels, I mean, it's inarguably a loss. That feels like a loss. It's a loss of data. It's a loss of contribution. And I'm not saying one way or the other that, oh, it's fine that the person did that, or it's not fine, or anything. I'm just identifying the compulsion as an open source enthusiast to look at it and think, well, that's a shame. Like that feels like a betrayal. But in real life, you know, using just sort of looking at things from an objective perspective, like we don't, you know, nobody knows. Like I don't know. I didn't research it, so I definitely don't know. But whatever, the person had to stop this project. It turned commercial. I don't know why. Maybe the person needed to pay rent, and that was the best bet they had to make that happen. Whatever. Don't know. It's just really nice that the open source licenses codify that process. And when it goes smoothly, it is very nice that transition happens. And again, I didn't do any research into this. I could be mischaracterizing all of this. But the fact that LensFun still exists today indicates to me that there was a transition there from open source to not open source anymore, fork of the open source to a new open source project. And I think, like, no matter where you stand on open source and closed source and commercial versus non-commercial and that sort of thing, I think that's like half the battle is communication and expectation. This was open source at one point. It is no longer open source, so we're going to fork this project. Is that fair? Yes, that's fair. And in fact, the project LensFun even specifically thanks PT PT Lens, I guess that was the project before Lens Fund, thanks the author for allowing this fork to occur. Again, I don't know what the licensing for the licensing was or anything like that, but I think that when this kind of thing happens, it is nice to know that an open source license can be invoked to make this transition of data smooth and, you know, fair, quote unquote, around fair, because who knows what that means, but it's fair. This person had a database. Other people probably contributed to it. This person decided to close that database. Everyone gets to walk away from that experience with the shared data, and they get to go in whatever direction they want to. The PT Lens guy could start selling copies of the database or whatever, and Lens Fund could continue to develop the database in an open source state based on what had been collected up to that point. That seems like a pretty fair starting point for both of those ventures. One or the other may have run out of steam at some point. Lens Fund didn't, but it could have. It doesn't have to still be around, but it is. I just can't help but think that's the process that's supposed to be happening here. I mean, like I say, compulsion is, oh, it's a pity that the open source thing went away. But the reality is that the process worked. We still have Lens Fund. So what's Lens Fund actually used for? Well, I couldn't remember what Lens Fund was actually used for. So I thought I remember seeing it in some KDE application. And sure enough, if you do an LDD on /user/bin/digicam, does that come with Slackware, or is that something I installed from Slack builds? That is a really good question. No, it comes with Slackware. Okay. So if you do an LDD on user bin digicam, and cam is with a K, not a C. So digicam. And then pipe that to grep lens fun, then you definitely see that liblensfun.so.2 is used in user lib64 liblensfun. Oh, that's, yeah, right. I forgot what I was looking at. So you definitely see that liblensfun is used in this, in digicam. That the output of LDD identifies liblensfun as a linked library to the digicam was compiled against liblensfun. So that's at least one place where it was used. I checked GwenView too, because I had like this notion that GwenView might use it as well, but no, it wasn't used in GwenView. So if you're using digicam or if you have it installed, if you've installed it, then you can launch it. If it's your first time launching, it's going to ask you what directory your photos are kept in. It defaults to pictures. That's a logical default. It's not where I keep my photographs. Pictures, to me, are pictures. Photographs are photographs. So I keep mine in user clat2 or /home/clat2/photograph. And in photograph, I have different directories of things that I have photographed. So for example, here are photos that I've taken at museums. Here are photos that I've taken outside, you know, nature shots of like plants and mountains. The best bet usually I find for testing, well, almost anything for photographs, but definitely for this kind of thing, for the lens distortion. I mean, unless you have a picture that you're looking at and you think that's weirdly distorted, like something's up, then a portrait shot, something with a human face in it, will very frequently be the thing that you want to look at, simply because we all know what faces are supposed to look like. That's why human faces in photos are so darned useful. We look at so many faces all the time, and it's one of the dead giveaways. When something is not quite right, we'll notice it in the face. So open up a portrait shot, if you have one, of somebody, and go up to the Enhance menu in Digicam. I mean, there's a lot. I start at the Enhance menu, but I mean, there's actually an editor in Digicam. That's the point. So I think I have mine set that if I click on an image, it opens it up in the Digicam editor. But I think if that's not your default setting, I think you can right click on it and tell it to open in editor, I think. I don't know. Like I say, I have it set to open in editor, so it's a little bit, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it's in a edit menu or something. I'm not sure. But I'm clicking on a photo, opening it in the image editor, and it's not anywhere near like a GIMP or a Krita level photo editor, but it's a useful editor. I'd say it's more or less a GWinView style editor. You know, you can do common things like red eye reduction, and maybe, you know, you can apply a blur or correct colors or apply some color correction, that sort of thing. You can also export it with a bunch of different formats. I mean, Digicam is actually really, really useful. If I did more photographs, I would probably use it. Well, I would certainly use it a lot more. And it's mostly menu driven. So you're going to find things like import and export menus. You find tools menu, effects menus, decorate menu. I never even used that. Transform for like rotating and flipping and cropping and auto cropping and resizing, and then enhance. And that's where I started just now, because that's where the lens auto correction selection is. So you can go down to lens auto correction, and over on the right side of Digicam, a lens auto correction dialog box or window, whatever palette, opens up in the side panel there of the application. And this is the lens auto correction panel. So all of the selections here apply to exactly this process. The first thing I do typically is show grid. That's the selection to just give you literally a grid over the photograph so that you can kind of see how things, you know, with if there's no grid, then when something shifts, you sometimes can sublimate it because you're not offsetting that shift by anything. Whereas if there's a grid, our brains tend to notice movement within each space. So it just, for me, it makes it more obvious. So I'm showing the grid, and that's just got a little overlay. And then you can choose the make, the model, and the lens that you used to make that photograph, to take that photograph. You may not have that information. Some photos have it in their metadata, some don't. It really depends on where that photograph came from, how you took it, how it's been saved and resaved and processed. So it really just kind of depends. But maybe you know your camera. Maybe you know exactly what you took this photograph with. In that case, you can choose the make. Also, I'll choose Canon. This wasn't actually my camera, but I happen to know which camera it was because I borrowed it. It was a Canon EOS Rebel, and actually I don't remember what kind of Rebel it is, so I'm just going to make something up. Let's say that it's a T2i. It probably wasn't, but let's say it was. And then the lens that was being used, I actually don't know which lens it was. That's kind of really, really essential. I mean, I know it was like something like a 52, it may have been a prime, a 50 prime. Yeah, here's 50 millimeter prime lenses. Prime meaning you can't zoom in and out with the lens. The lens is fixed. So this is a 50 millimeter. Let's just pretend like it's f1.8. I don't think it was actually probably that good. Probably more like, here's one. Here's a 50 millimeter 2.5. It says it's a compact micro lens, whatever. Okay, so selected that. Could, you know, making things up here. I can do a focal length adjustment in millimeters. That's in millimeters. So I can adjust that by some level. There's an aperture setting. So it looks like it's fully, it's weird. The slider kind of lies to you. So click around before you're convinced that things are what they should be. All right, I'm going to set it down to like 3-ish. Let's call it 3-ish. And then actually, you know what? Let's call it an even 4. It's better. It's more realistic. And then let's do subject distance. Let's say that the subject is about a meter away from the lens. And then, so once you have your settings dialed in, then you can do your lens correction to apply, and you can choose. In this case, there's chromatic aberration, which looks okay to me. I'm clicking it on and off and not seeing a difference, so I'm going to leave it off. And then there's distortion and geometry. And I really was expecting something for distortion, but there is apparently no... Oh, there it is. Yeah, okay. So clicking distortion will frequently, if there is something indeed to be corrected, that's usually the one that you'll really see something different, because that usually means like distorting the image, or you know, I guess you could think of it as undistorting the image, because you're kind of taking these curves in the image and smoothing them out. Like, no, you're not supposed to taper upward horizon near the edge of the lens. You're supposed to remain flat because, you know, lenses are round, and sometimes you'll get distortion on the around the edges. So that is how you could do that, and then you would click OK, which I'm not going to do because I don't actually want to apply made up corrections to an image that's perfectly fine. But that's using lens fund. All that information about the maker of the lens and the model of the lens and the lens size, all of that stuff is from lens fund, because, you know, they've collected all that information. They can detect common aberrations, I guess, in lenses and how it might affect an image, and then counteract it through various image effects and computations. And that could be really useful. I mean, it depends on the lens, you know? I mean, like, if you're perfectly happy with your photograph, then I wouldn't worry about it. And if you don't feel like lens fun is giving you the results that you think are necessary, then don't hesitate to use your own judgment. You don't have to go through lenses to try to unfisheye something. You could just do a manual distort and make it look correct to your eye. Remember, less is more. I mean, that's an important principle. But lens fun is definitely, especially if you've got a series of images and you recognize that the lens has not been perfect for those images, then lens fund can be a great way to do a bulk or a quick, you know, almost automated sort of process of fixing common mistakes. So that's lens fun as seen through Digicam. There are probably other applications that use lens fun, and you could certainly use it yourself. After all, there is a lib lens fun. So if you're programming, you want something to access common lens definitions and then counteract their effects or mimic their effects, lens fun is there for you. Okay, the next one in the list after lens fun, let's find out what it is together, because I'm clicking around as I speak. After lens fun is libAIO. This is the asynchronous IO library. Now, I don't have a whole lot of experience with this because I don't do this every day, so I could get some of the details slightly fuzzy in terms of what belongs to what. But libAIO, basically asynchronous IO in input output. The two basic sort of syscalls for that kind of thing, for input output on, you know, on the file system level or on the kernel level, really, are read and write. You can just type into a terminal man read. Oh, that is not the correct one. Okay, man two. That's the man space and then the number two, because this is in the section two section of the man pages. Man two read. There we go. Read from a file descriptor. And you could do the same thing with write. You could do a man to write and find out more about that. Those are the I and the O's, the ins and the outs, the reads and the, or the in would be write, the out would be read. That would be IO. Now so there's read, there's write, and then there's later came around P read and P write, and then even later there was P read V and P write V. All of those have man pages. You can read about them if you need to know about them. And there's probably more that I have not learned about or that I'm forgetting. So and that's just the Linux kernel options. Now there's also just the POSIX specification for that process, and either way, like whatever you're looking at, that was, I guess, sufficient for a while. I'm assuming. I don't know. I have no feelings about this one way or the other. I don't deal with things on this low of a level. But presumably it was all right enough for a while that people at least lived with it. And there are limitations, though. People recognize that there have been limitations. For instance, the async IO process is supported just for direct access or unbuffered access. So if you want to read or write with an intermediary sort of stopover in RAM, sorry, you can't do that asynchronously. You can do it when you're just direct reads, but you can't stash bits and pieces away to look at later or on the way over. There are problems, or there are things that some people don't love about the API, the way that you access these functions from within C or C++. So libAIO is the asynchronous asynchronous implementation that attempts to make it so that instead of inputting and out, you know, doing the IO process just as sequentially as necessary. Async means that you can do it not at the same time, you can do it, or rather, not as a call and response type of thing, you can do it asynchronously without synchronization. Is it the best solution possible for asynchronous input-output read-write type situations? I guess not, because in 2019, Jens the spelling is correct. I was saying maybe the pronunciation, Axbo, AXBOE is how you spell it. He's a software engineer, or was in 2019. I don't know what he's up to now. He was a software engineer at Facebook, and he was working on faster IO through something called IO_U-Ring. And through several different sort of demonstrations and talks, he has demonstrated that this is probably the faster option. So if you are running, I think 5.1 or later. What am I running? 5.15.38. Personally, you might be running something more recent. You might just be running whatever Slackware shipped with initially. I don't know. Whatever it is, if it's 5, I'm pretty sure it's 5.1 or greater, then you might be using... the kernel probably has shipped with IO_U-Ring, and some things might be using that. Now, it depends, I think it depends on the file system. I could be misremembering about that. It could depend on the file system. It could depend on, you know, what the application is using. Like, if you're using something that has been compiled against libAIO for some reason, then it's making that API call, then that's, you know, that's what it's going to be using. So quite possibly the fact that IO_U-Ring exists doesn't actually impact what you're actually experiencing right now today on your system. But the fact is that it is developing. A lot of different companies, like Intel and apparently Facebook, they're working on, I would imagine, well, maybe not. Yeah. Anyway, they're working on improving this process. And it's not about, from what I understand, again, if I feel like I could speak authoritatively on this if I actually did this kind of thing and saw the problems for myself, but I don't, and I don't, so I don't have any actual insight. And so maybe that's all I'll say, actually. I was gonna theorize about something, but lacking any kind of information on whether that's correct or not, I don't see the point. There are a lot of great papers on this subject, though, especially around that 2019 Jens Axbo presentation. So that's something to check out if you're interested in this kind of thing, if you're curious about where Linux is headed for asynchronous IO, then that might be something to take a look at. And I'll try to remember to link to some resource in the show notes, but you can also just look around. It's pretty well known at this point. IO_U-Ring. That's IO_U, the letter U, R-I-N-G. That's the latest and greatest asynchronous IO solution for Linux. And I mean, it's supposed to make real, you know, actual real improvements, like substantial improvements. All right, let's talk about libAO. That's audio output library. I've already talked about LAME a lot in the previous episode. I'm not gonna go into the same kind of depth here. I mean, not that this is even an encoder, but libAO is a cross-platform audio library. It's required by applications and libraries that use audio, such as Ogg123 or OggVorbis, or other things. And it provides plugins for OSS, ESD, ARTS, I vaguely remember hearing about ARTS, and ALSA. You need to install the supporting libraries for any plugins that you want to use. This is it's a C library. I mean, it gives you direct, really easy access to audio outputs. There's a pretty good example program in the package called I think AO, no, yeah, no, okay, AO underscore example dot C. It's in user doc libAO dash 1.2.2 or whatever it is. So if you look in there, you'll find AO underscore example C. You can take a look at it, and I think you get the idea of what it does pretty quickly, honestly. I mean, it does things like, well, I mean, first of all, it includes AO, AO.h, and then it sets some things like format bits 16, format channels 2, so it's going to be stereo, format rate 44/100, so it's going to be CD quality, device equals AO underscore open underscore live, parentheses, default underscore driver, comma, and format, comma, null, close parentheses, close semicolon. So, you know, I mean, it's setting up devices, it's opening devices by invoking libAO. This is all stuff that you don't have to figure out because there's a library to do it for you. This is really sort of significant, this kind of interaction for programmers, because without these libraries, you can have devices on your system and you would not be able, you would be able to maybe access them, but you wouldn't know what to say to them, or you wouldn't know how to interpret what they're saying back to you. So the fact that these kinds of libraries exist is kind of a big deal for a programmer, because that means now a programmer writing in C can, they don't have to think about that device. They can just think, I need a device, a sound device, or I need to get a list of sound devices, and then I'll let the user choose one, and then I can output sound to it or whatever. Now, whether libAO is actually something that's super useful today, I don't know. I don't know. I guess it could be. I kind of feel like a lot of people are going to be just writing to some sound server rather than, you know, certainly directly to a device. So I don't know how big of a deal libAO is in 2023, but the library itself is important because it provides that interface. It provides that sort of SDK, if you will, to access those devices. And it feels like it's time for a coffee break, so let's go get a cup of coffee, and we'll come back and finish up the show. Okay, I'm back. I've got my coffee. I've switched over for a little while to making my coffee in a plunger or a press. We say plunger here in New Zealand, which to my American ears, I think I've told you this before, I hear that as a thing that you stick down the toilet or a sink when it gets backed up. It's very abrasive to my ears, but people here call it a plunger, and so I'm calling it a plunger. But yes, in the US, people call it a coffee press. So I have used a coffee press, a plunger, to make my coffee, and it tastes amazing. I go through, you know, sort of a cycle here of sort of forgetting that I have a certain option for a coffee. And I think, I mean, for all winter, in fact, I forgot that I had a plunger, really. I kept making it in either my stovetop espresso maker or my stovetop percolator, and I was quite happy with it. And then for whatever reason, yesterday, I opened the cabinet where I keep my coffee, and I look in, and I noticed the plunger, and I thought, why don't I just want one cup of coffee right now, why don't I use that? So I grabbed that, made a cup of coffee, and it tasted amazing. I mean, can it sparkle? Does coffee sparkle? I mean, it shouldn't, but that's kind of like, if you think about sort of what sparkle makes you think about, as long as it doesn't make you think of like a sparkling water or soda pop or anything like that, but it was just such a bright and just happy and wide open kind of revelatory flavor. It was really good is what I'm trying to say. And this was just, you know, the same old beans as I've been having, so bomber again, but it just tasted amazing. So I've really been enjoying my single cup plunger coffee lately, and I just figured I should let you know. If you've got a coffee maker that you're forgetting about, switch back to it, you know, after a month or two. See what it does, because I mean, it'll surprise you. I think your taste buds get acclimated, and then you have to kind of like mix it up a little bit, and when you do, it's exciting. All right, so the next one in the list here is Lib, of course, lib app indicator over on Launchpad on Ubuntu's very special project tracker. Lib app indicator, it makes sure your Plasma 5 systems tray is functional in GTK applications, or I should say it supports GTK applications. So if there's a GTK application that you want to send to your system tray, this ensures that functions correctly within KDE. And I guess that's the only thing that exists for that. I don't know. I'm legitimately surprised that wouldn't just be something already in Plasma. Already, like just from the KDE project, in other words. But it exists here, so I'm assuming that that's where it comes from. Which, tip of the hat, thank you, Ubuntu. That's really, really great. Or maybe it's just yet another one. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's just another lib app indicator. Maybe there's another thing within KDE that does the same thing, but this has a different interface, and the Ubuntu programmers are using it because they prefer it. I don't know. I don't know the story, but I appreciate it. I certainly do. I don't know, you know, how many KDE applications I use that use the systems. Does Handbrake maybe? Maybe that does. So that I might benefit from that, although I haven't used Handbrake in ages now. So I don't know. I mean, there might be a GTK application out there. Firefox. I use Firefox. I don't think that uses this. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what GTK application uses my Plasma SysTray, but lib app indicator makes sure that it can, and that is appreciated. Lib archive, that's a library to, you know, create and read archives, again, from your C application. So if you're writing in C and you want to read in the data of an archive, or you want to create an archive, this is it. This is lib archive. It'll let you do that. And there's a bunch of formats supported. I'm not going to read them all, but from their github.com/lib archive page, you got things like old version 7 tar archives, POSIX, US tar, GNU tar, including GNU long file names, long link names, and sparse files, Solaris 9 extended tar, POSIX PAX interchange format, POSIX octet oriented CPIO, anything else interesting? ZipX, GNU and BSD AR archives, 7-zip, Microsoft CAB format, RAR 5, LHA, LZA, XAR, and more. So there's plenty there for people who need to look at an archive. And that's not it. That's not all. They've got test suite. They got a test suite. So if you go to their GitHub page, you can look at their test code and kind of get an idea of how to use this thing, which is always handy. I think it's always difficult, you know, when picking up a library, to know what to do with it, you know, where to even start. I mean, you know, you start with the documentation, that kind of thing, but sometimes it's just so much clearer to just see the code and get it. You just get it then, you know, or you don't, but you might get a start, and then you can look at the docs, and maybe that'll clarify. So it does have a test suite. You can look at it. It's very nice. Next up is lib async in S. This is an asynchronous name query library. Lib async in S is a C library for asynchronous name queries. It is an asynchronous wrapper around libc's synchronous get adder info API. As you might guess, this, because it uses the word name, this has everything to do with DNS, but it is quite small. Like, if you look at the package contents, what was it? Lib async in S. Yeah. So if you look at the package, it is tiny. I mean, it's potentially one of the smallest ones we have seen, with like all of counting the documentation, there's probably about 10 lines here. And indeed, the include file asyncns.h, and then there's a library. That's the package. If you were writing an application that needed to interact with the network, then this is one of the things that you might need to do to get DNS information. As Pat's description of it says, it does use other things. It uses the GNU git adder info underscore a library. It uses data from, or modules rather, from NSS. So it's not a completely, I guess, self-contained solution, but it is, it's available. You can interface with it through your C code, and it's probably, you know, it wrappers are, I don't want to go out on a limb here and say a blanket statement, but a good wrapper is a very nice thing. And I'm gonna assume that that's why this is here, because this wrapper is probably useful. I mean, it's been around since 2005, so I'm imagining that someone is finding this useful. Okay, libATA smart. It's a lean, small, and clean implementation of an ATA smart, that is self-monitoring analysis and reporting technology, reading and parsing library. Smart is a system used by hard drives to monitor factors that may impact drive reliability in the hope of predicting drive failure before it occurs. I think more interestingly, most interesting about this project is the author's statement of why it exists. He asks this question on his website. Why? Like the website from with the source code on it. He says, why? You might ask what the point of all of this is when Smart Mon Tools already exists. What I'd like to see on future GNOME desktop is that as soon as a disk starts to fail, a notification bubble pops up warning the user about this fact and suggesting that you make backups and replace the disk. For tight integration into a desktop, a smart implementation that is small and not C++ and a library that is embeddable into other software is highly preferable. Also, stuff like distribution installers should link against libATA smart, that's the name of this library again, to warn the user about old and defective disks before an installation even begins. And then he specifically calls out Anaconda developers. Hey, Anaconda developers, the Anaconda is the installer application from Fedora. Hey, Anaconda developers, that means you. It's a tiny library. All you need to do is a single call. Int sk underscore disk underscore smart underscore status parentheses sk disk asterisk d comma sk bool asterisk good close parentheses semicolon close parentheses. So wow, what a beautiful sort of statement that is. I mean, this is Klaatu again. So that was the author of libATASmart, and I mean, what a great idea. Like, yeah, let's have this thing be a library that can just be called in other software, applicable software, that can monitor the disk for you. Like, that just seems so obvious to me. Now, I'll admit, I don't have... This is a very hard thing to diagnose too, right? Like, when do you have a bad hard drive? It's really hard to tell. And it feels to me, at least, like when a hard drive goes bad, it's too late. It just always seems to be too late. So I've never had a great experience with hard drive failure. Go figure. Hard drive failure, not a great experience. Wouldn't recommend it. Luckily, I feel like I got most of my hard drive failure trauma, knock on wood, kind of out of the way earlier in life. Like, I've been there, I've done that, I'm pretty hypersensitive to it now. I back stuff up, I make duplicate copies, I keep stuff on servers. I have methods of mitigating expected loss. But would it be different if I had confidence in Smart? Possibly. I would like to have confidence in Smart, to believe that Smart is going to warn me without me having to ask that my hard drive could fail within a couple of weeks. Like, that would be great. That would be fantastic. I've never seen it though. So I don't know if GNOME just doesn't have it. I don't know if KDE just doesn't have it. Plasma Desktop just doesn't have it. Like, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I would love to see that. I think that would be a real benefit to the user. Now, I can imagine also, you know, getting annoyed at a pop-up. Everyone hates a notification, right? But I mean, that's easily configurable. You could build into that notification, okay, I've seen this notification, never warn me again, and then you just don't do the pop-up again. And I think that's okay. I don't know why you would ignore something like that, but I guess maybe If you see the notification on Monday and you think, all right, it's expecting a drive failure sometime. Well, I've backed up recently. I'm just going to keep using my computer anyway until my replacement drive arrives in the mail. Then, yeah, you would probably want to never see that notification again for the rest of the week because you know that you're going to get that replacement drive on Friday. But, I mean, yeah, this is 100%. Like, libATA Smart just seems like the obviously... Well, I don't know about libATA Smart specifically because I don't know anything about it, really. But to me, this seems like this is correct, right? Like, that seems really smart to me. I would want that. 100%. So there's a couple of things here within the libATA Smart package, ATA Smart package, and it sneaks up on you. It tries to hide, but they're in the S bin folder. That's why they're not like where they usually are at the top, user bin. It's way down sort of after lib64. So I missed them the first couple of times and didn't even notice that they should be there until I read up about the project on the website, which listed those skdump and sktest. So skdump, I imagine I'll need sudo permissions, maybe not. Okay. Yes, I do. Okay. So sudo skdump, let's just do a dash dash help first. This is essentially smartcuddle-a. That's what this kind of mimics. Skdump dash dash help says that there are a couple of different options. Well, the syntax is skdump and then whatever option, and then the device that you want to query. So dash dash overall, show overall status. Dash dash status, show smart status. Dash dash can dash smart, that shows whether smart is supported, at least in theory. We'll talk about that in a moment. You can get the temperature in kelvins. That's interesting. You can save the output, you can power cycle things, and so on. So let's try one. Let's do a sudo skdump dash dash overall on /dev sdc. It says it's good. That's all it says. It's just the word good. So I guess that's enough. You can get a lot more information than that if you just do sudo skdump no options /dev/ you know, whatever, SDA, SDB, SDC, whatever. That gives you a lot of output. It tells you the raw read error rate, the spin-up time, the start-stop count, reallocated sector count, seek error, and so on. So you really get kind of a look in a way. I mean, whether it means anything to you or not is a completely different story, but you do get a lot of data here, and I think, I mean, it vaguely looks to me like smartcuddle-a. For me, I don't know. I could be misremembering. I guess I could just try smartctl, sudo smartctl. Do I not have that installed? Surely I have that installed. It's successfully opened. -a for smart information. I forgot the -a. Okay. Yeah, it looks superficially like that. Yeah. It's basically the same thing. Cool. All right. So anyway, skdump, nothing, gives you a bunch of data about the thing. It tells you the device, the size, the model number, the serial number, I guess, the firmware, the smart availability, yes, quirks, awake, yes, smart disk health, good, yes, and so on. All right, so let's try, I don't know, SDA. Oh, actually, I'm going to go back to the short, the shorter. Good. Okay, so skdump dash dash status shows good for that one. Now, if I go over to, I think, SDE, it says failed to get smart status. Now, SDE is a traditional normal, I think. Actually, I need to do ls block to find out what SDE is. Yeah, no, it's a big USB. Maybe I need to power it on. Let's try that. So skdump or sudo skdump dash dash power dash on /dev/sde says it's not supported. So apparently I would argue smart is not supported on this device. So I'm going to do can dash smart on /dev/sde. And it says failed to query whether smart is available. So operation not supported. So I guess that's a no, or is that a third state? You know, yes, no, fail. So I'm not sure what that means. Maybe it means the drive is going bad. I don't know. I don't care. It's backed up in total. But, you know, whatever. Like, that could be a bad sign. And that's the kind of output that kind of isn't super useful, obviously, because it doesn't really tell me anything. It throws me into a kind of an unresolvable loop of, you know, this, it could mean it's fine, but that the device doesn't support smart, or it could mean that everything's going horrible and the drive is falling apart as I speak. I don't know that it failed. I mean, and I'm not saying that libattasmart should be able to deal with that, because I mean, if it can't, it can't, right? There's no helping that. That said, though, smartcontrol-a/dev/SDE returns a bunch of data. It says that the drive is there. It's working. It's available. Let's see. It's in the database. What else? Smart support is enabled. Smart support is available. The overall health self-assessment test result has passed. So it is. It's weird that libattasmart doesn't appear to be able to give the same information as smartcontrol-a. So not sure what to think about this. I like the idea and I like the goal. I'm just not 100% sure about, again, I mean, and this isn't just libattasmart. This is smart and hard drives. The level of confidence that I have in how easy it is to check, how easy it is to integrate into a system so that I don't have to check, and whether I can trust the results, it's not there still. And I don't know, you know, I mean, this is really, really hard stuff and well beyond certainly my understanding. I mean, it's amazing that such a concept even exists, you know, self-tests and self-monitoring, predicting a failure, like that just, it's fortune telling. It doesn't make any sense. So on the one hand, you know, like, I mean, ultimately, I think, yeah, you the fact is, you don't know. Like, your hard drive could die any day. So could you. I mean, sorry, dear listener, I didn't mean that as a threat. I just meant, like, you know, like, life is uncertain, right? Things can die. They can go bad. They can stop working. And that sometimes happens to hard drives. So back up. And if you want to use smart, if you want to use libattasmart or smartcontrol-a, do use those. Do I wish that Linux desktops had more to say about that? Yeah, I think overall I do. I really do. But again, I do not know what that would look like, because if Plasma Desktop were using and integrating libattasmart and I got a pop-up that said, alert, operation not permitted, failed on dev SDE, I wouldn't know what to do about that. That would freak me out. I mean, maybe it would make me back up that drive. So maybe we should just treat a fail as, you know, kind of like there's a danger of warning about a hard drive. But then that would be weird if you had just bought that hard drive, brought it home, plugged it in, and you get a failure alert, you know, or what would just read as a danger zone alert, because that wouldn't make sense. Like, I just bought this thing. So yeah, I don't know. It's tough. I don't know the right answer to this. I do think that it's really important that we make those tools available, and I would love for them to be sort of front and center. Like, yeah, I would prefer if desktops, Linux desktops, were a little bit more opinionated. I actually don't even like that word for computers, but I wish they had more to say, they were more verbose about the state of hard drives. I think I would prefer that. I don't want to swear to that, because maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it would be a bunch of nonsense data that would just confuse things. But I don't know. Could we try it for like a year and then turn it back off and see how we feel about it? I don't know. Anyway, that's libattasmart. It's great. It's a cool project. I'm excited that it exists. I trust it as much as I trust smart control, which I trust as much as I trust a hard drive, which I back up regularly. Go figure. Okay, let's do one more. Not for any good reason. Lib Blu-ray, open source library designed for Blu-ray discs. Playback for media like VLC or mplayer. I don't know how Blu-rays work. I don't know anything about them. I don't have a... Well, I guess I technically do have a Blu-ray player. I think PlayStation 3 had a Blu-ray. Did it? Maybe not. Maybe that was PlayStation 4. I don't know. Does anyone use Blu-rays anymore? Do people use DVDs anymore? I know. I've asked this before. I jokingly say that nobody does, and then someone quite rightly emails me and says, actually, I still use them. And you know what? I personally still use them. I just bought some CDs the other day, like from a little local vendor. They had local bands that had CDs, and so I bought them. So it is... Yes, they are all still used. Blu-ray, however, I will say, I've never had a Blu-ray. Well, that's not true. I had a Blu-ray, I gave it away. But I mean, I never had a Blu-ray player, except the one that I have over in the other room. What I'm trying to say is I do not indulge in Blu-ray. By the time Blu-ray was coming around, I basically had already sort of switched to just keeping digital files, so it didn't really affect me one way or the other. And I know Blu-ray is like super high res and amazing. I don't care. I don't care that much about my screen is not a definition that would betray the poor quality of a DVD. It's fine to me. So I mostly just I use digital files, and Blu-ray uses digital files as well. But you know what I mean? I have a file, a little icon on my desktop. I click it. It plays a movie for me. That's what I want. So Blu-ray never really excited me. This is libBlu-ray. If you use Blu-rays and you have a Blu-ray player for your computer, this very library could be the thing that you're using to watch that Blu-ray. What kind of encryption there is and whether this cracks it, I don't know. I've never used this thing. I don't know how anything about Blu-ray. But there you go. There's the library for it. Check it out. All right, that's it. That's everything. Let's end the show. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.